possible about the facts of the situation.
Out of curiosity, given that so many people say that there is genocide underway or something that strongly resembles it, why wouldn't this convention be involved?
Well, I think, as you know, this becomes a legal definitional thing, unfortunately, in terms of as horrendous as all these things are, there becomes a definitional question.
That was Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, speaking in 1994. Ken Roth, you were Human Rights Watch Executive Director at the time. We don't have much time, but explain what the U.S. didn't do.
Well, first of all, these word games with genocide were because there was a perceived obligation that if there is genocide, you have to suppress it. You have to act. And so they said, oh, it's maybe acts of genocide, which they thought meant something lesser. Now, this was the moment, it's hard to think back, but this was before Bush's invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. It was an era where Americans were very unused to the idea of American military casualties abroad. And Clinton was just not going to risk it further after the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. So he was determined not to send in troops. It's important to recognize that the Rwandan genocide was carried out by a rudimentary force, basically using hate radio, the infamous Radio Milkolin, to rally people with machetes to kill their neighbors. And Alison DeForge, my colleague at the time, who was really one of the world's experts on Rwanda, was convinced that two forces could have stopped the genocide: the UN peacekeepers, UNAMIR, and a French evacuation force that was sent in. But the French evacuation force evacuated the Westerners and left Rwandans to their fate. The UN Security Council, at U.S. urging, reduced the number of peacekeepers from 2,500 to 250 and never gave them a protective mandate. And so as a result, the genocide unfolded. And when Clinton, apologizes today, it's because he did nothing to stop the genocide. Indeed, I remember we were meeting with Anthony Lake, the national security advisor of Clinton at the time, and he said, make more noise. In other words, we're not going to stop the genocide as a legal duty. We're not going to stop the genocide because we have a moral responsibility to do that. We're only going to stop it if there's no political cost, if the American people are demanding this of us. That was the complete abdication of moral responsibility of the Clinton administration.
And Ken, we only have about a minute left, but what parallels do you see with how the U.S. Acted or didn't act back then to the war we're facing right now with on the part of Israel and Gaza?
Well, one, interestingly, it would be easier for the U.S. to act today. In other words, in the case of the arms sales end tomorrow.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And by the way, I want to say that at the time, 1994, Madeleine Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, then became Secretary of State. I want to thank Ken Roth, who is former executive director of Human Rights Watch for for close to 30 years, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And I want to thank Noel Zahabamwe, who is founder and chair of the African Australian Advocacy Center, speaking to us from Australia, a survivor of the Rwandan genocide. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to remind you that everything that's said today on the program is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members, and strictly the views of myself. So welcome. Welcome to The Angry Young Man, that wonderful, amazing time of the week, depending on whether or not it's a Tuesday or a Thursday. Welcome, and that statement might not make sense right now, but this does re-air on Tuesdays. So, hello Tuesday people, you're in the future. Now, I was supposed to have a guest today. Said guest has played hooky. It's okay, you know, I don't blame them. It's beautiful outside for the first day in a couple days. I mean, you don't have to look too far outside the window to see that it's sunny and, you know, at least a little warm. I'm glad it's not, you know, torrential downpour like what ended up. I don't know if any of you saw the point flooded. Then those the poor people that mulched PNC Park. Just have to go and probably redo that. But I digress. Anyways, so given the fact that this is no longer going to be the discussion that we were going to have, going to be doing something a little different. See, I'm an economics student, and economics is a kind of passion area for me. Definitely enjoy talking about the wonderful, fun world of economics, and that doesn't, you know. Some very pertinent stuff to speak about as it relates to the issue of economic policy currently in the United States. Particularly, you look at the issue of current spending at the federal level and the inflationary results of it. So kind of want to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to speak a little bit about, you know, well, and I'll get into this a little bit, with inflation and massive spending comes the devaluation of the U.S. dollar, which makes it a less attractive method of spending or saving. Where some people have looked to replace that then with investment in either precious metals like gold or silver, and some have gone to digital currencies. Many have decided to go that way, inclusive of our federal government, looking to create a central bank digital currency. I'm talking a little bit about the inherent issues with the central bank digital currency and why we should be afraid of it, potentially. Or concerned at the very least. Not necessarily afraid, but maybe concerned at the outset. Definitely some scary things in there. But also, then finally, kind of wrapping around, talking about how this all goes back to the grander issue of banking. Not just central banking, but banking on the whole. So, if this all kind of resonates with you, stay tuned. But if it doesn't resonate with you, I believe that this is something that you could listen to. It would be fun to listen to, potentially. Keep an open ear. See what we have going on. But before we do launch into that, also just letting you know that WRCT is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full coffee bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches and breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, and hang with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email PR at WRCT for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Also, just a couple shows here on WRCT. We have From Here to Eternity. Everyone thinks they know the 80s hits, but on the other side of the Atlantic lies a treasure trove of synth-drenched sounds that filled the airwaves of Europe back in the day. Take a trip back to the 80s you never knew with DJ Tony Tunes, From Here to Eternity, Mondays at 4 p.m. Also, we have Kaleidoscope. Tune into Kaleidoscope, an eclectic hour of music with your very own DJ Kate, Mondays at 8 p.m., only on WRCT Pittsburgh. Add to the colorful mix by calling in requests. Well, anyways, now that we have that out of the way, let's get to the meat of the program for the day, talking a little bit about these wonderful, wonderful economic topics. So, inflation. Basically, one of the large issues that we've had in the past 3 or so years is massive, massive deficit spending. Now, deficit spending, spending more than we're taking in taxes. And you can't look at this issue without looking at specific examples like our Inflation Reduction Act, which, surprise, surprise, did not help inflation, as well as the infrastructure bill that was passed. Both have a very large price tag on it. We're talking trillions of dollars. Now, we take in a sizable amount of tax revenue, an egregious amount, but the amount of money that we were spending on these two bills combined is not something that we could really put the gap with our tax revenue. So the expenditure is outpacing what we're taking in. So as a result, we have to borrow. We have to borrow the money to spend, which inevitably results in the Federal Reserve needing to kind of keep pace by printing more money. Now, what does this mean? If you print more money, you are going to devalue the currency. And the reason this being is if you have, like, if you have so the basic economic supply and demand, there's demand for money. And if more people are demanding more money, the less money there is, the more valuable each individual dollar is because there's less of it in circulation. You print more money, more people are going to be able to get $1 on average, which means that they're going to be able to acquire it, and they're going to have less of a desire to kind of put up more value to that because there's just more of it there. So you kind of scale this out. You flood the economy with new money. Money is worth less because there's just more money, hence the issue of inflation. You slowly lose the value of your currency. And this is something that tended to not be a crazy issue for a while, mainly because we had the gold standard. Now, the gold standard basically ended up tying the value of our currency to a set amount of gold that we had in our national reserve. So you could never really go beyond whatever amount of gold you were able to put into our reserves. That severely limited the ability to grow the money supply and protected, at least in some ways, the buying power of the dollar, the purchasing power of the dollar, which made it easier to save, which made it easier to be able to afford things. And what happened was, as we moved away from it and we moved to what we call now fiat currency, which is basically the currency is worth as much as we're willing to say it's worth. It's not backed by anything except the, quote, full faith and credit of the United States. Now, the full faith and credit of the United States, because the United States is a large country with a large military, means a lot. But it's interesting to think if, you know, there's a lot that we're able to get away with as a country of our size and influence, particularly as it comes to our monetary and fiscal policy. If we're able to exert our influence abroad, we're able to get away with irresponsible policy when it comes to that. We don't have to worry about the dollar being undercut because the dollar is used in most as the means of international exchange. We don't need to worry about the issues that are inherent to printing this money and devaluing it because people aren't moving away from it. What are they going to turn to? And this is where countries like Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa have moved to form the BRICS currency union to try to counteract that. Hasn't become an issue that's too big just yet. We'll keep an eye on it. But all this to say that we're kind of digging ourselves into a deeper and deeper hole where it hasn't necessarily become apparent how bad it is yet. Just because we're living in the kind of rose-tinted reality of being the world's superpower still. and we don't have to worry about our consequences for our actions just yet economically. But there's a really good Ludwig von Mises quote. Now, he is someone that I'm going to reference a little bit today because he says a lot of good stuff as it relates to this issue of inflation, monetary policy, fiscal policy, and the necessity to be prudent and exercise restraint when it comes to these issues. So he said something which I think explains this well, and it's talking specifically about the economic policy of the United States. If I can find it really quick, it is something that I go back to often, and I think I've got it right here. Yes. So one of the privileges of the rich man is that he can afford to be foolish much longer than the poor man. And this is the situation of the United States. The financial policy of the United States is very bad and getting worse. Perhaps the United States can afford to be foolish a bit longer than some other countries. And this was said in the 1970s by Milton Friedman. Not Milton Friedman, sorry. Von Mises. Milton Friedman is someone I'm going to bring up a little bit later. But von Mises outlined this issue just as it was getting bad. Von Mises is unfortunately no longer with us. But if he saw how things were looking right now, it would be a mix of I told you so and shock and panic. and I think that's a valid response because what we're looking at is a slow descent into – like we're not facing the consequences of the pit that we've dug ourselves into. But eventually we're going to have to climb ourselves out because we're going to realize that we've run out of food and water and we're slowly starving at the bottom of this pit that we've dug for ourselves. And we're going to have to climb out. And it's going to be a very painful process when that eventually hits us. So we've continued to pursue this. And it's concerning that it's both parties that pursue this agenda of massive fiscal irresponsibility. You have Republicans that will, you know, cry fiscal responsibility under a Democratic administration, which is valid. Because Joe Biden, as president, has spent a ludicrous amount of money when he had the Democratic trifecta at the beginning of his term. But we can't look at that and then also not look at the fact that under Republican administrations, the amount of money that's been thrown at the military and other projects, which have cost billions of dollars, are also equally as fiscally irresponsible. And we've kind of just gotten to this back and forth of spend, spend, spend. And even when we're, you know, looking at, you know, Republicans who are claiming that they're for fiscal responsibility, they're not acting on it. And they're, you know, it's just kind of an issue of the rot of the system in some ways, but it will come back to bite us. All that to say, that's kind of the issue on the fiscal irresponsibility side and what that ends up looking like for, you know, what is perpetuating the issue. But what does that look like in the real terms? What does that look like for people who have to deal with the results of inflationary policy? I think we saw a lot of that as a result of the COVID era inflation. You know, it was a very real thing to see prices increase for gas, for our groceries, for things like that. And that was a very real example of that. But this has been happening for a very long time, even pre-COVID. You saw the issue of prices. If you looked back at, like, how much did a soda cost in the 1950s? And it was, like, 50 cents. But now it was, like, $2.50 about 30, 40 years later. And it has a lot to do with the diminishing buying power of the dollar. And it only got worse as we abandoned the gold standard. I mean, it's only getting worse. Things are only getting more expensive. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's just ongoing diminishing purchasing power of the dollar. Now, this will happen naturally over time, and it should happen on a very long slope trajectory. But it's happening very quickly. And when it happens very quickly, people cannot catch up. Wages do not catch up. Wages increase over time alongside these prices, and that's how it should happen, as there are just more people We need more money in circulation in order to accommodate for that. But that's a very critical thing to understand, that the pie is not finite when it comes to the ability for people to get money. The pie always grows, and there's enough room at the table for everybody. But when the pie is not growing and everything else is, it becomes very difficult to hold on. And that's kind of what we've seen as a result of the COVID-era inflationary policy. Inflationary results of COVID-era policy. And it's not getting any better. It's getting worse as we've kind of dropped the facade of trying to be at least fiscally somewhat responsible. The price tags we have on government projects now are still at COVID levels of spending, which, you know, even Keynesians who say that we need to spend our way out of the, you know, pandemics and the recessions, are kind of looking at what we're still doing and they're like, you know, pump the brakes. Even that's too far. And it's continued to be, this is why you'll have issues where, you know, prices are still high and wages are not catching up. People are arguing for government to step in. And what you do by kind of artificially pushing this along faster is so something that's very critical to understand is the market does not move as one unit. The market is fluid. The market moves in kind of an ebb and flow. And that's the thing that's important about inflation too. Inflation does not happen all at once. Inflation kind of spreads out across the market. And that's one of the major issues with, you know, when we print a lot of money, the people that are closest to the printer are the ones that benefit. They get the immediate effect of having more money in their pockets, but prices have not adjusted in many parts of the economy. So they have an advantage over most people who have not had the opportunity to gain capital. By the time that effect hits wages for people that are furthest away from the faucet, people who are working in education, people who are working in like things that are very far away from the financial sectors, those people lose out most. And that's where, you know, the issue of, you know, how do you deal with that? You want to keep inflation low, because then you end up with this disjointed system. And trying to push for increases in wages when that effect hasn't leveled out only exacerbates the issue, because you end up hurting the people that need to pay out these salaries, who are themselves also suffering from high costs. So it's a whole jumbled mess. And a lot of people, as a result, are trying to turn away from traditional American currency, particularly as it comes to digital currencies, Bitcoin, your Dogecoins, things like that. And that's become very popular in the past 10 years. Some people are not crazy about it still as an investment. Some people are. But what's concerning is how the government has attempted to move itself onto this bandwagon as well by establishing a central bank digital currency. Now, it's functionally the same as other digital currencies. But the concerning part comes in when you see the reports that have been put together that argue for this to be a primary currency, to move away from cash. Now, we've been moving away from cash for a while. There are cashless businesses where you cannot pay in cash, which I think is ridiculous. I whenever I go to a business that does not accept cash, I am deeply appalled. That's just a personal thing, but it's most people don't pay with cash. As someone who's worked at in food service, where you're working either a cashier or waiting on tables, most people don't pay with cash. They pay with card. So we've already kind of moved mostly away from cash, and this is where the government has seen an opportunity to introduce an official currency which solely runs digitally. And this allows them the ability to monitor and control currency with greater ease. Now, when money was just little silver coins that we traded and were printed out by the, you know, like, countries of the times, the mints of France and Great Britain, stuff like that, you know, that was very hard to control. There was no monetary controls there. And as we moved towards the, you know, modern monetary system, it became easier to control money, especially once we ditched the gold standard. Government could print money, relax the monetary supply, tighten it, do whatever they needed to do with it. Monetary controls became very easy. But the thing that they couldn't do until recently when we started to digitize our transactions was monitor where money was going with greater ease. And that's what you are able to do when it comes to digital transfers and stuff like that. Government is able to much more effectively see where is the money going, how is it flowing, who's spending what, who has what, and try to affect monetary policy with greater degrees of information. There is a lack of privacy in monetary, in fiscal exchange now. And with central bank digital currency, it only gets worse. Because when the money is no longer partially physical, when the money is all digital, the gloves are off. Everything is subject to the control of the government. One of the scarier things, outside of complete lack of privacy, there is no privacy in transaction once we go to central bank digital currency. Every transaction is seen. There is absolutely no privacy. Now, some people may, you know, make the, I call it the Patriot Act argument, that, oh, you're supporting, you know, terrorism by trying to push back on efforts to clamp down on terrorism. Oh, you support, you know, money laundering or things like this if you don't want government to be able to see where money is going. No. The statement of the traditional, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, is ignorant of the, you know, the desire of those in power to control what is being done, to kind of groom societal behavior by discouraging certain things. And that's something that's already done and can be done even further with a central bank digital currency. The thing that you can do with central bank digital currency that you can't do with any other currency is the scariest thing, I think. Negative interest. Now, positive interest is a very intuitive thing. You know, you put your money in the bank and over time it accumulates interest and you can like get a little extra bonus on top of whatever you put in for holding your money and being a wise citizen who's prudent and saves. Now, say the government wants to increase expenditure, like they want more people to spend money. They can institute negative interest on money. And if you hold on to your money, if you don't spend your money, it loses value. It is a direct tax on your savings, more than just the depreciation of buying and purchasing power. They can literally just make your money be worth less for holding on to it or any other reason. That's scary. That's very scary. And that's something I always point to and say, you know, be weary of this when people argue for central bank digital currency, because that's to have a lack of control over your own finances, be at the whim of other people's desires and goals. That is a scary and stark lack of freedom. You know, we're so quick to accept convenience and safety as things that we will exchange our freedom for. You know, we're willing to give the government the ability to, you know, spy on people for the stated purpose of combating terrorism. But as Edward Snowden pointed out, by whistleblowing on the NSA, the Obama administration was going way beyond just spying on terrorists and spying on American citizens, innocent American citizens. We have, you know, like I spoke about last week, the TikTok ban, you know, for the stated goal of combating Chinese interests, but giving the executive the ability to ban any, you know, stated foreign adversary that has social media presence And that's open-ended. And that's the same issue with this. You know, stated convenience of being able to be completely digital and not deal with the hassle of physical currency, the outdated, you know, paper exchange that we have going on. You have to be very careful with the Faustian bargain of safety for freedom, or freedom for safety, or freedom for convenience. I forget exactly where this is. I believe it was something that was said in Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where the issue of slowly delegating to government the responsibilities that we as individuals take on by virtue of being free people, taking care of our own expenses, trying to provide for ourselves, things that we at the outset were doing for ourselves but slowly delegated to government, you know, save my retirement fund for me, government, you know, take care of education for me, government, do these things for me so I don't have to worry about them. I want the convenience of ignorant bliss, of being able to kind of just float around and let you take care of it. Being, and it was almost kind of likened to, you know, it's the nanny state. Let government be our shepherd as we're guided as blissfully ignorant sheep. That's the inevitable outcome as we slowly delegate our freedoms away to government for convenience and safety. And that's the issue that is inherent to a lot of what our conception of the role of government has become. And that is inherent to the issue of dealing with central bank digital currency and monetary and fiscal freedom. It's a cautionary tale of, you know, just how much are you willing to give up until you realize that it's very hard to give things away. No, it's very, very easy to give things hard. Apologies. It's very hard to get things back once you've given them away. It's very hard to gain back your monetary and fiscal freedom once you've given it away to government. It's very hard to get your privacy back once you've given it to government. So, on this somber and kind of doomy note over here, I mean, you tuned into a show called The Angry Young Man, who's kind of ranting and raving. You'd expect a little bit of a kind of Debbie Downer attitude to it in a lot of ways, but I have hope. You know, I definitely think that a lot of people post Snowden kind of woke up to a lot of this issue and have kind of lost it in the past 10 years, but I don't believe it's ever too late to turn back, to kind of acknowledge that there's a necessity to reclaim a lot of what we've delegated to government mistakenly. You know, there's a lot of responsibility tied up in freedom. Freedom is power. And in the wise words of Uncle Ben in Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. We have the absolute distinct opportunity and the privilege of being able to be free in this country. Something that in most countries, not even half of what we guarantee is guaranteed. But we need to be ready to stand up and hold that. You know, hold on to it, cling on to it, because as so many other people in other parts of the world know, freedom is a very precious thing. And we shouldn't be so quick to give it up for the sake of convenience. On that note, I wish you all a very happy rest of your day, a very wonderful rest of your day. Take care, God bless, and stay free. Because you could do that here, and it really is a beautiful thing.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a senior UN human rights official told the BBC that there is a plausible case that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza, a war crime. Meanwhile, U.S. citizens struggle to make sense of White House policy that seems to call for getting aid to Palestinians while pursuing a course of action that makes that aid necessary, if insufficient. Phyllis Bennis is senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, an international advisor with Jewish Voice for Peace, and a longtime UN watcher. She joins us with thoughts on the evolving situation. Also on the show, as reporter Alex Salmon outlined 5 years ago in the American Prospect, the Boeing scandal is an exemplar of the corporate crisis of our age. Putting resources that should have been put into safety, into shareholder dividends and stock buybacks, selling warning indicators that alert pilots to problems with flight control software as optional extras, and outsourcing engineering to coders in India making $9 an hour. These weren't accidents. They were choices made consciously over time. So why are media so excited about Boeing CEO stepping down, as though his taking one for the team means changing the playbook? We'll hear from Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Reuters reported on March 22nd that the United Nations Security Council had rejected a resolution proposed by the U.S. calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage deal between the Israeli government and Hamas. Russia and China vetoed the measure, readers were told, while Algeria also voted no and Guyana abstained on a measure that, quote, called for an immediate and sustained ceasefire lasting roughly 6 weeks that would protect civilians and allow for the delivery of humanitarian assistance, close quote. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, cited in AP, said that the U.S. had been working on a hostage deal for months that would call for a six-week period of calm from which, she said, quote, we could then take the time and the steps to build a more enduring peace, close quote. Well, what does that wording mean? And what do UN resolutions generally mean if politicians and news media interpret them variously? So helping us to sift through these attempts to respond to the violence of Israel's ongoing war on Palestinians in Gaza is Phyllis Bennis. She's senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, an international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace, as well as author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
Well, so the U.S. introduced a resolution at the U.N. nominally calling for a ceasefire, but also vetoed another resolution calling for a ceasefire because Thomas Greenfield said it would interfere with negotiations around freeing Israeli hostages. And then there's this effort to portray the current decision as non-binding. It's very confusing, especially for lay people. Does the U.S. want a real ceasefire or not? What's happening here?
Well, you raise all the right questions, Janine. The real issue has to do with the U.S. view of the United Nations, which is that it's annoying at best and a threat to U.S. domination at worst, mm-hmm. from Washington's vantage point. So that earlier veto by Russia and China and opposition by Algeria, the abstention by Guyana, of the U.S. resolution came after a history, a long history that goes back years, in fact, of the U.S. vetoing calls for a ceasefire in situations when Israel is attacking mostly Gaza, on occasion Lebanon. And the Security Council calls for a ceasefire, and the U.S. says, no, we don't need a ceasefire yet, always meaning we haven't killed enough people yet. Mm-hmm. So there's a long history of that. We don't really have time to go into that. But the U.S. did it twice in a row on the Gaza question, where there were proposals for a ceasefire that the U.S. vetoed, which would have passed. The U.S. refused. Then the U.S. comes up with its own resolution, which was a very, very sneaky one. Because that quote that you read about what it says, those words were indeed in the resolution, but it did not call for them. The resolution did not call for an immediate ceasefire. There was a recognition by the Security Council, according to this resolution, that a ceasefire would be a good idea. And then went on to say, and therefore, the Security Council should go on record cheerleading, they didn't use that word, but saying should support the U.S.-controlled negotiations that are already underway in Qatar. So it was a fake resolution. That's why others did not like it and weren't willing to accept it as if it were an actual call. In international law, which is very complicated in a lot of ways, but certain parts of it are pretty clear. One of the parts that's pretty clear, Article 25 of the UN Charter, says that all decisions, all resolutions passed by the Security Council are international law. They're all binding. That's what the real world of international law says. So when a resolution is passed, it needs to say the Security Council demands a ceasefire, period, full stop. If it talks about how the Security Council recognizes that such and such would be a good idea, that's nothing to be binding on,
right?
That's just a statement of what we think is nice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what was distinctive. The new resolution that was passed just a few days ago that the United States was willing to allow to be passed 14-0 with one abstention, the U.S. abstained rather than vetoing it. That was a great step forward. And that one, crucially, did call for an immediate ceasefire. And it also called for the release of all the hostages and compliance with international law in the treatment of all those detained by all sides, which is a clear reference to the Palestinian prisoners that Israel is holding. And it also, crucially, demanded lifting all barriers to the massive amount of humanitarian assistance that's desperately needed as famine is moving across Gaza. So that was a huge shift. At the same time, the U.S. had weakened it in many ways. It removed the word permanent from the description of the ceasefire it was demanding,
right,
and said, we just want a lasting ceasefire. Nobody knows what that means. And crucially, the other weakness was that the ceasefire is only called for 2 weeks. It said that the ceasefire should last for the month of Ramadan. But it was passed 2 weeks into Ramadan, so there's only about 2 weeks left.
Right.
So that's way too short. And there's other limitations as well. But it was a very significant shift in the U.S. position, and it really speaks to how the Biden administration is hearing, if not yet fully responding to, but feeling like they have to answer the demands of this rising movement that is so powerful across the United States and now globally, saying we need a ceasefire now and we need access for massive amounts of humanitarian aid without any of the barriers that Israel is putting up. Those things are desperately needed.
Yeah.
And what we're looking at now is a question of how that movement is rising, what the impact could be on the elections. That's one of the biggest pressure points for the Biden administration. If they want to win this election, they have to be seeing that the only way to do it is to change their policy on what has been, up until now, unconditional support for Israel. With all the language about criticisms of Netanyahu and the massive amount of press about how there's this big divide between Biden and Netanyahu, between the U.S. and Israel, that's true only on the level of talking. On the level of acting, The U.S. hasn't changed a thing. $4 billion a year as a starting point of military aid. All the additional weapons that Israel wants, Israel gets. There's just been no shift in the reality that the U.S. is arming and financing a genocide. And as long as that's underway, there's people across this country that are mobilizing this uncommitted campaign in places like Michigan and Minnesota, where those votes really matter. And it's spreading. It's about to happen in Wisconsin. And at the end of the day, this isn't just about the election. This is about what has to happen to stop this genocide. And I think what has to happen is that there has to be a way of convincing Joe Biden personally, not just others in his administration. And right now, the pressure is rising, and the issue is going to be how much longer can he keep up the political credibility when he has people in his own administration resigning in protest of his policies. He has the staff of his own Biden-Harris campaign committee coming out with a public letter saying, Mr. President, we can't do our job. We can't get you reelected with this policy. You have the White House interns. This is my personal favorite of all these protests. Mm-hmm. These are the most ambitious kids in the country. They all want to be president, right? And yet they're willing to come out and say, Mr. President, we are not leaders today, but we aspire to lead in the future, and we can't do it with this kind of a model when there is a genocide underway. So the U.S. can do all it wants to say that this is a non-binding resolution, but that's just not true. They can go out of their way to say that the South African initiative at the International Court of Justice that led to a finding that Israel is plausibly committing genocide right now or is moving towards a genocide, that extraordinary brief prepared by the South African legal team somehow is, quote, meritless. They can claim that, right, but the rest of the world isn't buying it. And increasingly, U.S. voters aren't buying it.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, I do see also just a lot of regular folks reading things like U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood calling for a lengthy pause to this conflict and saying, well, we're not calling for a pause to the conflict. We're calling for a resolution. We're calling for a way forward, you know, and then you right. see with concerns about a wider war, we have folks like John Kirby, White House National Security Council, on the Today Show saying, well, quote, we don't want a wider war in the region, but we got to do what we have to do, close quote. This is terrifying, but I also feel like folks are seeing through it. And so maybe let's end on that note, that folks are figuring out that this politics speak, you know, they're seeing it for what it is and, more importantly, for what it isn't.
That's exactly right, Janine. And I think the good news, if there is any, in this extraordinarily devastating time of real genocide in real time in front of our eyes on an hourly basis, the good news is, exactly as you say, more and more people in this country and globally are seeing through those false claims. It's a false claim that the UN resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire is not binding. It is binding. It's a false claim that the South African charges at the International Court of Justice were meritless. They had all the merit in the world. All of these claims are designed to distract us. It's all a distraction. The change in language is a distraction. What we need is a real ceasefire. That doesn't mean 2 weeks to release all the hostages and then we go back to war.
Right.
That's not the point here. The point is to stop the fighting, stop the slaughter, stop the denial of food and water and medicine, which is deliberately causing massive starvation on a level that all of the experts in international humanitarian crises admit is the worst they have ever seen. Not in terms of ultimate numbers, because the population in Gaza is not very big, but in terms of the percentage of people. Never have we seen 100% of a population facing extreme hunger, with 55% facing immediate famine. This has never happened before, as long as the international humanitarian organizations have been tracking famines. It's shocking. And the fact that it is going on while we watch with weapons that we provide, that we pay for with our tax money, is finally reaching everybody in this country. More and more people are saying, no, not in our name, not with our tax money, not anymore.
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis. You can find her recent work on UN resolutions on Gaza on commondreams.org as well as ips-dc.org. Phyllis Bennis, we have to end it here for today, but of course we'll stay in conversation. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
Boeing CEO David Calhoun is going to step down in wake of ongoing safety problems, as headlines have it, or amid 737 MAX troubles, or elsewhere mishaps. Had you or I in our job made choices repeatedly that took the lives of 346 people and endangered others, I doubt media would describe us as stepping down amid troubles. But crimes of capitalism are accidents for the corporate press, while the person stealing baby formula from the 7-Eleven is a bad person as well as a societal danger. There are many reasons that corporate news media treat corporate crime differently than so-called street crime, but none of them are excuses we need to accept. Public Citizen looks at the same events and information that the press does, but from a bottom-up, people-first perspective. We're joined now by the president of Public Citizen. Welcome back to Counterspin, Robert Weissman.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Well, Boeing is a mega corporation. It has contractors across the country and federal subsidies out the wazoo. But when it does something catastrophic, somehow this one guy stepping down is problem solved. You know, I mean, what happened here versus what, from a consumer protection perspective, you think should have happened or should happen?
Well, I think the story is still being written. Folks will remember that Boeing was responsible for two large airliner crashes in 2018 and 2019 that killed around 350 people. Result of that, as a law enforcement matter, was that Boeing agreed to a leniency deal on a single count of fraud. They didn't actually plead guilty. They just stipulated that the facts might be true and promised that they would follow the law in the future. That agreement was concluded in the waning days of the Trump administration. Fast forward, people will remember the recent disaster with another Boeing flight for Alaska Airlines earlier this year, when a door plug came untethered and people were jeopardized. Luckily, no one fatally injured in that disaster. But the disaster itself was exactly a consequence of Boeing's culture of not attending to safety, a departure from the historic orientation of the corporation. And from our point of view, directly a result of the slap on the wrist leniency agreement that they had entered after the gigantic crashes of just a few years prior. So now the Department of Justice is looking at this problem again. They are criminally investigating Boeing for the most recent problem with Alaska Airlines flight 1282. And we are encouraging, we think they are looking back at the prior agreement, because the prior agreement said if Boeing engages in other kinds of wrongdoing in the future, the Department of Justice can reopen the original case and prosecute them more fully, which it should have done, of course, in the initial instance.
Well, let's talk about the DOJ. I'm seeing this new report from Public Citizen about federal corporate crime prosecutions, which we think would be entertained in this case, and particularly a careful look back at choices, conscious choices made by the company that resulted in these harms. And this report says the DOJ is doing slightly more in terms of going after corporate offenders, but maybe nothing to write home about. Yeah.
Right. There was a very notable shift in rhetoric from the top of the DOJ at the start of the Biden administration, and not the normal thing you would hear. Much more aggressive language about corporate crime and holding corporations accountable and holding CEOs and executives accountable. However, that rhetoric hasn't been matched in good policymaking. And we had the lowest levels of corporate criminal enforcement in decades in the first year of the administration. We gave them a pass on that because that was mostly carrying forward with cases that were started or not started under the Trump administration. But we've only seen a slow uptick in the last couple of years. So it has increased from its previous low, but by historic standards, it's still at a very low level in terms of aggregate number of corporate criminal prosecutions. By the way, if people are wondering, like, what numbers are we talking about? We're talking about like 113. So very, very few corporate criminal prosecutions as compared to the, you know, million of prosecutions of individuals, as you rightly juxtaposed at the start.
And then even historically, there were more corporate crime prosecutions 20 years ago, and it's not like the world ended. You know, it didn't drive the economy into the ground. This is a thing that can happen.
Correct. The corporate criminal prosecutions don't end the world, and moreover, corporate crime didn't end. So we ought to have more prosecutions than we have now. I mean, we're just talking about companies following the law. This is not about aggressive measures to hold them accountable for things that are legal but are wrong, which is, of course, pervasive. This is just a matter of following the law. There's no sense in which holding corporations accountable for following the law is going to interfere with the functioning of the economy. It doesn't diminish the ability of capitalism to carry out what it does. In fact, following the rule of law, for anyone who actually cares about a well-functioning capitalist society, should be a pretty core principle, and enforcement of law should be a core requirement.
And one thing that I thought notable also in this recent report is that small businesses are more likely to face prosecution. And that reminds me of the IRS saying, well, yeah, we go after low-income people who get the math wrong on their taxes because rich people's taxes are really complicated, you guys. You know, so there's a way that even when the law is enforced, it's not necessarily against the biggest offenders.
Yeah, that's right. Although the numbers are so small,
it's hard to tell.
That disparity isn't quite that stark. I think the big thing that illustrates your point, though, is the entirely different way that corporate crime is treated than crime by individual offenders, street offenders. First of all, the norm for many years has been reliance on leniency agreements. So not even plea deals where you plea down, a corporation pleas down, or a person might plea down the crime to which they are admitting guilt, but a no plea deal in which they just say, hey, we promise to follow the law going forward in the future. And if we do, you won't prosecute us for the thing that we did wrong in the past. Human beings do not get those kind of deals, except rarely in the most low-level offenses. But that's been the norm for corporations, for pervasive offenses with mass impact on society, sometimes injured persons, and instances where the corporations, of course, are very intentional about what they're doing, because it's all designed based on risk-benefit decisions about how to make the most profit. The sentences and the punishments for corporations in the criminal space and for CEOs in the criminal space are just paltry.
So if deterrence, really genuinely preventing these kinds of things from happening again, if that were really the goal, then the process would look different.
Oh. It would look radically different. You know, I think there's a lot of data when it comes to so-called street crime. You need enforcement, obviously, against real wrongdoing, but tough penalties don't actually work for deterrence. It's just not what the system is in terms of the social system and the cultural system, people deciding to follow or not follow the law and so on. But for corporations, deterrence is everything. Mm-hmm. They are precisely profit maximizing. They're the ultimate rational actors. If the odds are good that they will be caught breaking the law and suffer serious penalties, then they will follow the law almost to a T. So this is the space where deterrence actually would work. And we see criminal deterrence with aggressive enforcement and tough penalties really missing from the scene. And this Boeing case is the perfect example that the company was responsible through its lax safety processes for two crashes that killed 350 plus people. They got off with a slap on the wrist. As a result, they didn't really feel pressure to change what they were doing, and they put people at risk again. If they had been penalized in that first instance, I think you would have seen a radical shift in the company, a much more adoption of a safety culture. We would have avoided this most recent mishap.
Well, let me finally just bring media back in. You know, there was this damning report from the Federal Aviation Administration last month, and the reporting language across press accounts kind of incensed me. You know, this is just the Seattle Times. A highly critical report, they said Boeing's push to improve its safety culture has not taken hold at all levels of the company. The report, the paper said, cites a disconnect between the rhetoric of Boeing's senior management about prioritizing safety and how frontline employees perceive the reality, close quote. Well, this is corporate crime 101. You know, I mean, there are books written on this. It's not a disconnect, you know. Oh, the company's at war with itself. Leadership really wants safety really badly, but the workers just aren't getting it, you know. This is pushing accountability down, you know, and maintaining deniability at the top. So the CEO doesn't have to say, oh, don't follow best practices here, you know. They just need to say, well, we need to cut costs this quarter. And everybody understands what that means. Anybody who's worked in a corporation understands what corporate climate means. And so I guess my hopes for appropriate media coverage dim a little bit when there is so much pretending that we don't know how decision-making works in corporations, that we don't know how corporations work, when I know that reporters do.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is so 100% correct in characterizing what happened at Boeing. Because not only is that fake and obviously culture is set from the top, this is a place where the culture of the workers and the engineers wants to and long did prioritize safety. They're the ones who've been calling attention to all the problems. So right. It's management that's preventing them from doing their jobs, which is what they want to do.
Yeah.
I think in terms of how media talks about this, I agree with your point. And I think the reporting on Boeing has been pretty good in terms of documenting what happened. But what is often missing from even really good reports in the mainstream news media is the criminal justice frame.
Mm-hmm.
Now, admittedly, that partially follows from the failure of the Department of Justice to treat it as a criminal matter seriously. But I think it does change the way people think about this stuff. If you call it a crime, it's exactly as you said, it's not errors, it's not just lapses, it's certainly not mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
These are crimes, and they're crimes with really serious consequences, in this case, hundreds of people dying.
We've been speaking with Rob Weisman, president of Public Citizen. You can find their work on Boeing and many, many other issues online at citizen.org. Robert Weisman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can learn more about FAIR on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
I'm from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT. Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT...
Alex Patterson from the Orb, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh on 88.3 FM. Suckers.
After you hurt me, after I hurt you, and all of our bad dreams one by one came true. We said it was goodbye, but the eyes never lie, and I knew that it was only jive. So you found a new lover to wear your crown, and I found a cheap flat up in Chinatown. I saw you with stone stars in chic bars downtown Mars, but I knew that it was only jive. You cut me loose, I hit the juice, somebody deep inside me died. Punch that tune, who hit the moon, who made the dime store gypsy lie? I hit the juice, somebody deep inside me died. Who punched that tune? Who hit the moon? Who made the dime store gypsy lie? You ain't got no love, Jones, not for me, not much. How come the sparks fly every time we touch? The meaning becomes clear every time you are near. But maybe it's only jive. Maybe it's only jive.
Two.